Welcome to this week's episode of Unsolicited Feedback. This week, I'm joined by a new co-host, Joff Redfern, who's a VC and partner at Menlo Ventures and previously CPO at Atlassian. Today, the two of us are joined by our old friend and colleague, Sean Close, who is currently CPO at Confluent, the makers of Kafka, and also has previously run teams at Atlassian, like Joff, as well as MuleSoft as part of Salesforce and many others. This episode is a little bit of back to the roots. We just have a basic riff. We start off talking about products that we've used recently or topics that we find interesting. And that one ends up being pretty winding. We cover a ton of different topics. We talk about single function devices like Rabbit. We end up talking a little bit about autonomous vehicles. We end up riffing on Hamilton Helmer's seven powers, Legos, calculators, content creation, a ton of different things. And I think it's a really fun conversation, really like a happy hour between three product leaders just talking about what's on their minds. Part two, which will drop later this week soon, is more of a focused deep dive where we give unsolicited feedback to Devin, the new software AI agent made by a new startup called Cognition Labs, as well as to Reddit on the eve of their IPO, which should be coming this week. We hope you enjoy these two episodes. I haven't caught up with either of you in a long time, or ever in the case of Joff. We don't know each other all that well yet. So I was just curious what y'all are up to, Sean. Let's start there. What are you working on right now?
Yeah, I mean, I have a 1.5-year-old and a 4.5-year-old. So certainly that takes up a lot of the time. But yeah, for about the last year and a half, I've been chief product officer at a company called Confluent.
Yep.
Confluent. And we make not Confluence, Confluent.
Right.
Just to be clear.
Confluence was the last thing.
Josh knows a lot about that too.
Yeah. I'm working on both of those.
Yes. And actually, I still get confused. Yeah. So I've been at Confluent for about a year and a bit now. We're most famous for making Kafka, which many engineers or developers in the audience will know is kind of the way that people stream data between different applications. So I've been here for about a year and a half. And before that, I was at MuleSoft, which is a Salesforce subsidiary for 4 years. And that was like a really fun ride. It was kind of like being a rocket ship in a rocket ship. It was like the fastest growing cloud at Salesforce, which is itself a very fast growing software business.
Right.
That was pretty fun. Before that, I was in insurance. And then I worked with Joff briefly at Atlassian. I was there for a long time and he was there for a very long time after me.
Exactly. I think we were there long enough for Sean to pass the baton.
Joff, you're new to the VC game, so you probably are... Mm-hmm. Relatively new, right? Year or two?
Yeah, no, I'm even shorter than that. I'm 6 months into the gig.
So a big part of that probably is just trying lots and lots of new stuff. I'm curious if there are any products, tech or otherwise, that you've poked around with recently that have stuck with you that you want to recommend to the audience.
Yeah, obviously everything that's going on with AI has been such a mind bend as you step back. I think products that really exceed your expectations or do something very unexpected really lead to this level of wonderment. And a lot of this has been shared out there, but I think that OpenAI model, the Sora model, was really quite amazing and fantastic. It really opens up your mind to what is actually possible. Yesterday, there was a product that came out from Cognition, which was an AI agent for engineers. I find that to be pretty incredible. But yeah, the role of being a venture capitalist is quite different from being a chief product officer at a really large organization. So there's been a lot of learnings of that over the last 6 months. You go from, as the CPO, you're constantly meeting with your team, you're doing different reviews, you're always trying to hire someone, there's always talent management going on. And on the VC side, you're waking up every day and it's much more of a solopreneur job where you have an amazing team that you get to work with. But by and large, you're out there and you're trying to meet with founders that are doing the next big thing. And it's such an outlier business that it's not just meeting any founder. It's about meeting the founder that, or the founders that will be onto an idea that will really have some durability to it and make a difference in the world. So that's been super fun to be able to sit down every day and you have a string of meetings with just amazing founders. Everyone that I meet with, I always have this level of admiration for because they have the courage to start something new. You really have to start there, right? You're looking for an outlier, But every conversation, even if you don't believe that's necessarily going to be an outlier business, you just have such admiration of, wow, you came out of a well-paying job, or you're starting your career, and instead of going towards an established company, you're trying to start something new. And that part of the job is, that's never going to get old for me. I love that. I love building things, and I love seeing things get built from the foundation up, you know, the zero to one. So that's been a real blast about this role.
It's a bit weird because it's a little bit like joining the military, becoming a VC, because realistically speaking, firstly, you're changing careers a little bit. It's tech adjacent. So it's very much in technology, but it's a completely different kind of set of behaviors and this outlier search and meeting with people. So it's less a million little decisions every day and more one or two decisions every year that have all the outcomes. And then you have to wait 10 years to see the outcomes of those things. So broadly speaking, if you're in VC, you're in VC for 10 years. There's no point in joining to be a VC for 1 year. Or 2 years.
Right.
You know, right. So it's a very interesting career transition.
Yeah, the feedback loops are so extenuated from what we're used to. But, you know, there are a lot of similarities to it, too, because at some point in your career, and you know this, as a chief product officer, you're starting to manage business units, and you're starting to manage huge, sizable chunks of business. So seeing how those businesses are run gives you an insight into trying to pick what the next thing actually looks like. I had also started to do some angel investing before I had joined Menlo. So that thought of being able to put money into people and then helping them through that journey, but also helping them where your hands are off the wheel now. So it's eyes on road, hands off wheel kind of a journey. And there's something to be said about that, where it's nice to be providing wisdom, guidance, knowledge, learnings, but then you're not in the arena actually grinding through it. And that part I look forward to. And then the last thing I would say is you get a diversity of work problems. So every company that I've worked on, you tend to, over time, you get very siloed into what are the problems that this company faces? What's the competitive architecture for this landscape, and how do we attack it? And when you're a venture capitalist, you have this luxury of being able to step back and say, okay, well, I've got some investments in this area. I've got some investments in that area. So that diversity of businesses that you get to work on, I find really exciting as well.
As I reflect on certain moments of my career and I think about what I'm getting out of it, one of the things that you have to worry, not worry about, but that does become real as you stay at, especially a big company for a long time, is that answering the question, am I getting better at building products, or am I getting better at building stuff at company X? Is what I'm learning, the politics here, the way we get things done, non-transferable stuff, what gets me more and more ingrained at being awesome at my job, but also isn't as applicable or valuable elsewhere? Or am I learning the types of things that help me be better no matter what I'm working on or where I'm at? And one of the benefits I've been doing advisory and consulting work is in over the past like 6 to 9 months is really trying to figure out what are the lessons learned that are broadly applicable or patterns that work across multiple businesses, not, you know, one size fits all, but what's the hash table of if this, then that, like things you can look at, or, hey, it's a little of this and a little of that. Versus, especially as companies get big, I don't know, Sean, I imagine it was like this probably at Salesforce, is there's a whole bunch of like how to get things done at Salesforce that's just unique to that particular organization and its idiosyncrasies. Some of it's valuable, good communication, stakeholder management, et cetera, but it's all adjacent to building things. And there's something fun about working with founders, early stage founders, because the only thing that matters is building things. And it's really fun to work with people at that stage.
Yeah, I can see this thing from all different sides. You're definitely right, Farid, that an organization as big as Salesforce certainly has an internal politics. And actually, kind of all organizations have politics.
Yeah.
You know, when I joined Salesforce, my mentor executive, he said to me, Sean, the very first thing you should do is keep the training wheels on. Wait 6 months, don't make any decisions, learn what Salesforce does, learn how Salesforce does things before you try and do anything at all, because you need to understand the way the wheels of the organization turn. You need to understand how it works before you can truly master the organization. And that was a bit deflating. I'm a little bit like, oh, seriously? So I basically have to join this company and basically spend all of this time. But I've also realized since then that even smaller organizations, is sometimes the answers are the easiest things in the world. Like some, the answer to the problem, the answer to the market problem or the product problem or the HR problem or the whatever is easy. Getting it done always involves convincing the people to care. Yeah. It always involves convincing a bunch of people that the problem is worth solving, that it's urgent, that it's on them. You have to kind of enlist and inspire people kind of in every job everywhere. And so sure, I agree that Salesforce is its own special beast in that way, but it is surprisingly common in every business that you have to try and figure out how to enlist and inspire people.
Yeah, it's almost too bad, right? Because that is common advice and it's good advice and there's some wisdom in it, but there's also this point in which you're only a new employee once. And the freshness through yeah. which you view the organization is shortly thereafter going to be built up with all of the internal biases and guidance and ways of doing business. One of the reasons why I always held that APM program so closely to me at both Atlassian and LinkedIn is these young folks coming out of university would come into the organization, they would see it for the first time. And they would see our products for the first time. And they would always have these really keen insights because they weren't adjusted yet to our way of working. And some of those insights were on the product. And then other times they were insights on how work actually gets done.
Yeah. I would love to jump back a little on the Sora thing because I was going to talk about something similar that I saw recently that I thought was really, really cool. Is I somehow came across a tweet video from a guy whose name is Martin Debelong. He's an artist who's been using a bunch of AI tools to do cool things and build cool projects. And what's really interesting about his work is he's figuring out how to control AI tools in interesting, normal artist ways. So, for instance, setting up real scenes with objects using a camera and then using some tools to turn the image off his video into a 3D or a rendered thing with a prompt in between. So he'll set up a couple of jars with some flowers in it and then be like, do this in a painterly style. And he can use real world objects to control. Or he uses another tool called Kriya.ai. I don't know if you've heard of it. Pretty cool AI tool that allows you to draw things with and add prompts to control the output in ways that artists might normally control inputs and outputs, which I think is really cool. Because, you know, I spent the first 6 years of my career learning the details and vagaries of how Pixar works. And a huge part of building animated films is about making it be the thing that's in the director's head, right? It's not just type a prompt and get an output. That's cool and you get something good. But what if I say, I need these bushes to be like a little bit over to the right so it better frames the character's face? Or we do a lot of faking. So a lot of the job for me as a technical person at Pixar was like faking physics to make it look good enough, but also tell the story in the right ways or make the visuals look right, et cetera. So there's all kinds of behind the scenes mess. And so I'm always thinking about controllability in creative tools and how much artistic input. And it started to feel more like bicycle of the mind kind of stuff versus like magic black box that makes cool looking stuff, if that makes sense. So this guy's got a lot of like cool little demos. He uses a bunch of different tools, some PS5 thing called, I think, Dream. I'm not sure exactly what it is. Kriya.ai, some of the OpenAI stuff. So I'm excited to see what these kinds of tools can do because I'm really excited about the world where a super creative, really thoughtful storyteller with a great visual sense can build AAA style movies, films, short films, YouTube videos without having to hire a massive team or have a ton of technical skills in a bunch of different areas. Some of the animation stuff is a little janky with the Sora visuals, but a lot of the physics stuff, it turns out you don't need to simulate waves. You just need to have seen a lot of video of waves to make waves look good. Because what's important is not that it's physical and perfect from a physics perspective. What is important is that a human sees it as feeling like it hits the right beats and doesn't look fake. And it turns out some of these AI tools can trick your mind into thinking they've been physically simulated in a bunch of different ways. So I am super excited for Sora to be a real thing versus just a set of demos. I am super excited about creative tools. I think there's just so much cool stuff happening there. And it's been really cool to see how actually differentiated my friend Nabil Hyatt did, you know, same prompts as the Sora ones into a bunch of different tools, you get very different outputs.
Yeah.
So if you want something to look a specific way, we need this other layer of control. And I don't think anybody's figured out what that really looks like yet. So I'm excited to see what creative people come up with on the tool side to make this stuff.
Yeah, it's interesting that these tools are not deterministic. So they can spit out different things, even the same tool with a slightly different prompt, or even the same prompt at a different time of day might produce something slightly different. One of the things as I play with tools like Midjourney is that you're describing in English what it is that you want, and then you're getting a visual thing back. And then again, you're trying to go at it in English to describe how you want to manipulate the image. And you're like, no, I have a pencil. Let me just draw over here. I need some stuff. And this thing goes over here and I need some text here. And I think whenever we get one of these new interfaces, the whole world has to catch up with how do you work with that. When we moved from the website to the mobile screen, we went from a large screen to 3.5 inches and we had to learn how to manipulate it and to work. And I think some of the challenges on particularly these visual tools is people are visual thinkers. They think in photos and visuals and things like that, but there's not a handy way to manipulate that. It feels like we're trying to manipulate it with DOS, you know, this command line prompt, and you're like, okay, this needs to evolve.
I don't know if you saw the multimodal model stuff. That's where it's really, really exciting. So multimodal models are ultimately trained on both text and images. Like they don't really care. Effectively, they think of input that is an image is roughly the same as input that is English, or both at the same time. And they're extremely powerful, and they can do really cool stuff like Joff was just talking about, or what you were just talking about, Fareed, where you're manipulating a thing by, you take the image, you draw an arrow on it, and say, fix that bit. You know, they can inherently do that because they ultimately think about the world in those multimodal ways, which is kind of incredible. They can go even further than that. Like, you can end up with things like, I see some people are building like game engines now. Game engine engines. I don't know if you guys have seen that, but you put in a textual description of the game you want to build. You describe its art.
Yes.
You describe the dynamic. And then you edit the bits of the game, and then it respits out more of the game. So basically, it's like literally, you think about it as like a game studio with all the art, all of the game dynamics, all of the everything operating in this kind of refine it, random, refine, until you get to something that feels really good.
Yeah. I think there's a lot of analogs to like the early days of computer graphics for some of this stuff, which is that a lot of this was you typed code and then an input image came out and you were like, I need to work on the code more. And over time, we've evolved to more visual tools, more UX, more paradigms, et cetera, to be able to edit and allow the, you know, people with the creative skills to be able to directly manipulate these things over time versus having to always intermediate through someone who's technical. So I think it'll be really interesting to see the UX paradigms that come out of this. It's funny to think about, but someone had to invent the mouse and the GUI and like the WIMP interface, as we call it, right? That didn't exist until we had monitors and graphics cards and computers that could put images on screen in real time at a refresh rate that made sense and at a resolution that was useful. Someone had to invent that. And I'm curious to see like revolutions in user experience design around the fact that you're no longer directly manipulating, but you have a smart intermediary on almost any task that you do. And right now, it still feels like we're trying to use the old UX to control these new LLM intermediated things. And I hope there's something interesting, that someone will invent something interesting.
Oh, yeah. Well, and I think some of the tools like the AI Pen and Rabbit and others where, you know, if you start to think about natural language as being the input device, having something that's ambient or always present, an omnipresent device, you start to think about, well, what is the form factor? So seeing things where, you know, there's stuff in the glasses, like I bought the Meta Ray-Ban glasses, and you can touch on the side and say, hey, Meta, and there's AI always available to you. That AI pin, maybe it's like Star Trek, and there's something, you know, some lapel item that you put to yourself. So I think the watch is a, you know, an obvious one as well, because you got it sitting on your wrist. And of course, we got a phone in our pocket at all times. So I think that stuff will continue to evolve as well.
I bought a Ribbit or whatever that thing is called. Yeah. I haven't gotten it yet. But
nor have I. But the guy, day one, it was like, of course, at that price point. Yeah, I can't be a geek and not buy that.
Yeah.
I think what's really amazing about all of this is, I don't know if you've all also played with the open source models like Llama 2 or any of the other derivative models, right? These things run on my MacBook just fine, like no problems at all. You can get smaller models. It's like having a human brain in your pocket. Like this brain, this thing can run on device on an iPhone. Right, like it's, and it will always be as smart as it is. It's like we're living in the Jetsons age. Like it's a truly, this is a really fantastic time to be alive. You can ride to work in a Waymo. You can ask an intelligent AI assistant to do literally meaningful work for you. It's like, you know how there's that old, supposedly Bill Gates said that people expect things to change quickly, like faster in 2 years, but slower in 10 years. And it feels like we're in that moment. Like, you know, Alexa skills have probably been around for 10 years. Now look at what we've got. Context-aware fill in Adobe Photoshop. You'd remember that, where you can fill in a little bit of an image and just magically fill it in. Now we've got Midjourney. And today, Starship went into orbit, you know? Like literally, like just living in this truly unbelievable time. It's like we were moving so slowly for a little bit, and then all of a sudden it went like this. Like everything just turned. Very exciting.
Yeah, you go through these discontinuous jumps. It's like you've got normal science, and then all of a sudden it's like, okay, this is a new level that you hop up on. I do feel like that. And I've been in the Valley my whole professional career, so I've been through lots of these waves, but it does feel exciting and novel and substantial.
Yeah. I mean, just so much stuff in just the past week. This podcast is like hard because I feel like we spent all our time talking about AI type stuff. But honestly, when you talk about what products have been interesting recently, that's what's happening right now.
I can talk about my calculator. I just found my HP 17B2 Plus that I had in graduate school a gazillion years ago. And I put some batteries in it. And I got to say, having a single purpose device that has a tactile and you touch it. And I had programmed all these formulas into it, these financial formulas. And I can go back and I had to write the formula itself out. So it has a little solver in it. And there's something joyous about that single purpose device that's really simple and you understand how it works. Or like a Kindle. Like I haven't broken down and bought a Kindle, but I am always very tempted because it's like, it's a really great reader. And I do use Kindle, but I'm always using it on a multi-purpose device, which is heavier and a brighter screen. And we could talk about this calculator for like an hour.
It'll be interesting to see if those types of things come back. I have a bunch of friends who use a Remarkable tablet, which is like a note-taking tablet. Yeah. It's an e-ink tablet. And they say, like, versus an iPad, it's much, much better because it's non-distract. There you go. Sean's got one. He's a believer. I don't own one yet.
Sean's like the poster child.
So
he's sponsored by them.
Yeah. I'm curious what drives that for you. Like what makes a single purpose device like worth having?
I just find that they're incredible for being present. So if you're into meeting or something and you want to write notes or something, as soon as you open your laptop lid, you're immediately bombarded by Slack and everything else. And people assume that you're just multitasking. So they stop being interested in you as well.
Right.
Secondarily, there is something, I don't know what it is. It must just be to be human. But when you write things down, it's almost like you never need to look back at your notes. It's because you wrote them down that you can remember them. It's the physical thing. It's the physical thing of writing. And I just don't get that. So yeah, exactly right. And it's funny because you know, no amount of technology can change our wetware. I mean, we're like these buggy systems that have been rolling around on Earth for many thousands of years, you know? And so the question is, how do we have devices that kind of work with that, not against that?
I jokingly call my notes write only because I write them down and I almost never go back to them, but I cannot be in a meeting without a notebook in front of me. And I think the Remarkable would, at least if I did need to go back to it, make it much easier to go back to. But a super interesting thing I've found. So my son is taking a math class that's a little hard for him. And he's been, you know, really working hard at it. And he's doing a great job. I keep telling him to use pen and paper to solve these math problems because I'm like, it's going to be a lot easier. But for him, and I wonder whether this is just when you're young, the neurons are matched in the right place. He uses the editor in the online portal thing to figure out the math stuff. And occasionally he'll write stuff down. But for me, I can't imagine solving an equation on a screen. I have to do it on paper because that's the way I learned to do it when I was young. And it is interesting that while we're buggy, kids are very malleable. I wonder how much that's going to change and how much these tools will affect the way people actively think and work. Maybe we think you need pens to edit screens, but maybe if you grow up writing prompts to do it. It'll just naturally to you. So who knows? Maybe we're wrong.
Yeah, you just blew my mind, Farid, because like, I had assumed that literally everybody needs pen and paper to solve a significant math thing. Like, I'd like to the point that like, if I have this need for math, like my immediate thought is, where's a pen and paper? Like, I just can't physically cannot do it. And so it's amazing to imagine that that's not a universal experience, that in some way that's learned. Like, we learned that in some other way, just like we learned so many other things. I can't imagine that is true, but I'm willing to believe that it is. It's just one of those things. It's an axiom in my mind that I need.
I still think he'd do better if you use the pen and paper. I'm pushing him on it, but yeah, I might. Yeah.
Yeah. Give up on that.
Yeah. Don't give up. Yeah. That's good. Yeah.
Agreed.
Have you guys seen the videos around Figure, which is this humanoid robot? I think OpenAI is an investor, where you can just talk to it and it like moves things around and does stuff. It is this feeling, Sean, of I don't even know what to do because everything's changing so quickly. That, Joff, to your point, I don't even know how founders take leaps right now when the curve is changing so steeply that your idea today might be totally obsolete in a month. Whereas I feel like for the past 4 or 5 years, we had a pretty good landscape of what the business opportunities were and what technology could do. And it wasn't like databases were suddenly going to be 5 times as powerful or whatever, 150, maybe 5 times, but not 300 times.
Yeah.
And so you could say, hey, if the technology changes, that'll just make me better at my job. Now it might just obsolete your product.
Well, you know, it's interesting because I like 2 changes have happened. One change is everyone's read Innovator's Dilemma. So the incumbents don't seem to be as incumbent-y and old and crusty as they used to be, because it's all these next gen, you know. Yeah, Amazon is still a relatively young company and it's been through the cycle. It's like, I'm not going to let that happen again. And then I think the second thing about AI is that it really is a sustaining as well as a disruptive technology. Take a place like Atlassian. You know, there's a workflow. It's been around for quite some time. There's a way to enhance and enrich that workflow that Atlassian will certainly pursue and will make those products better. So it's not like there was the Atlassian version and then there's this new AI version that is going to come out of nowhere. I think the competitiveness of the folks that are incumbents today makes this feel different.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
No, I mean, there's no equivalent of Steve Ballmer calling the iPhone a toy.
Yeah.
In this era of tech, incumbent CEOs. Maybe there are around the edges, but of the big companies you think of, Amazon, Google, Facebook, Microsoft.
Yeah, it's as important as, water and electricity. So, if the CEO thinks that this is as important as water and electricity, we're going to be focused on it for sure.
Yeah.
I think it's also another one of those examples where, to some degree, in its current form, does potentially help the incumbents more than it does any new entrant, because data, the AI tends to be as useful as the information you bring to it, the data you have to bring to bear is a different way of saying what Joff just said, which is like, there are these known workflows. Bringing AI to bear on those workflows is one thing, but also if you happen to also have all of the enterprise's data already, then helping people surface more of that data, get more value out of it, is easier than being, well, I'm a new AI tool. First, give me all of your data, and then I will give you back something useful. And so it's weird because you imagine that this is going to be like massively disruptive, like it'll blow up a bunch of different industries. But in the way Joff was just saying, it might go the other way. It might consolidate power in a bunch of different technology industries.
Bob Baxley has a really good analogy, and he was saying, remember classic Legos, the 2x2, the 2x4, 2x6, 2x8, and you kind of build them up. That's kind of AI today. Like, people are taking a new blue AI block and they're putting them into the workflows that had previously existed. But then at some point in Legos history, they introduced techno Legos, and there were rods and wheels and gears, and the kinds of things that you could build were totally different. So I think some of the more exciting stuff is not just AI-ifying the current workflows that exist, but someone stepping back and saying, hey, now that we have AI, would we still build that workflow the way that we built it? Because things in sales and marketing, tools that we use in the software development lifecycle, these things are all rooted in tools that are decades old now. So I do think there's an opportunity for someone not too steeped in the old way to come in and say, hey, this doesn't really make sense to me. Why wouldn't we just start over again? And I think that kind of a dramatic change is what would give an up-and-comer an opportunity to take a run, because the incumbent's not going to, everyone's so familiar, millions of people are familiar with how to use our software, and there's a conceptual model that underpins the whole thing. You're not going to just walk away from it. You're going to try to use AI to move it towards the future where someone can come up and just say, I'm going to just start over.
Yeah.
And that carries a bunch of risks with it. But I do think that's part of the excitement. Those are the kinds of things that I'm looking for is, who wants to start over in the new world?
Yeah. There are incremental productivity improvement type things that AI brings to the table. And that those are probably going to get done by incumbents and actually be very successful for them. For instance, you're already coding in Visual Studio. Let me use GitHub Copilot to be able to go faster. Seems like it makes a lot of sense to do that. Whereas on the other side is, can you solve a job to be done fully? So one of the analogies we used was like AI writers, help me write things, but maybe build and execute and ship the SEO strategy for my company, almost like the way a service company would frame what their job to be done is, as a product would be very hard for some of these other tools to do, because it's a change in business model. It's a change in target customer. It's a narrowing of use case. It's a bunch of different things that like Google Docs isn't going to do, or Notion wouldn't do. And so I think focusing on these end jobs to be done and asking how much of this can I actually not just do the work product that's an input to it, which is, I think, where a lot of the co-pilot strategies end up happening, but rather, can I deliver a fully finished output is where I think there is startup opportunities.
It's interesting because it's both the hardest and the easiest, isn't it, for AI? Because by making it very domain specific, you're reducing the overall kind of scope of the problem. So it's not just write English, solve math. Literally solving it at the domain. The challenge also, though, is as the specificity of the solution goes up, the expectations of the user increase too. So the tolerance for errors, if I'm no longer a co-pilot, you better not crash the plane. Like, if I'm not flying the plane with you, we're not going into the mountain, are we? And so there's just this interesting dynamic that goes up. 90% might be good enough in a personal injury document of some type. It's probably not going to be good enough if you're Boeing and it's like a safety documentation or, something like that. That's definitely
Maybe 90% is good enough for Boeing, given their freezing challenges.
But yeah. It has been for the past 5 years.
Yeah. And so it's interesting to think about that. I don't know if you guys have ever kind of had the opportunity to ride in a Waymo. I referred to it a little bit earlier, but many people have experienced a Tesla self-driving, which is, often good, sometimes trying to kill you, right? And I mean, that's how I feel about
mine. Tries to kill me more than it's helpful, but yes. Okay,
mine is easily 95% of the time good, 5% of the time trying to kill me at high speed. And so okay, that's not great. But the Waymos are really unbelievable. And I guess that's what's kind of the product of how much time they have been working on these things, the patience they have to keep working on them. Many of them drive around my house here in San Francisco. I don't know why. It must be a training area. And so I often see them in the morning when I go for a run, all sorts of stuff. And I see them do things that you would be impressed if a average driver did. Like when they're going up a road and there's not enough room for two cars to get through, I've seen them reverse out of the way and wait for another car to come past. I saw a person illegally come out into the road going the wrong way down a major road, and the Waymo didn't just hit the brakes. It racked it away as human would. It's like, well, there's some room over on the left-hand side. I'll move over into the left-hand side. I won't hit the brakes because that will disturb all my passengers. It's going to be okay. It moved over into the other lane. The illegal vehicle going the wrong way down the road went past. It just moved back in and kept driving. These systems, maybe it's one of those things where we know that it doesn't take very much to get to 80%. But it takes a huge amount of effort to get to 100%, just a truly enormous amount of effort to get to 100%.
Yeah.
But when you get there, it's truly magical. From my perspective, I remember 10 years ago, we debated, was self-driving ever possible? And I know that people are still debating that. And I accept that that's a fair debate. But honestly, as far as I'm concerned, it's a solved problem. It's a solved problem because I would easily get in a Waymo more than I would your average Uber. And I just never would have thought that I would be in that situation. I'm pretty confident kids will never have to drive. And I know people have been saying that for a long time, but it just feels like this technology can be solved.
No, as well said. Waymo is amazing.
I think this idea of 80% to 100% is just interesting to dig into as a mental model for a second. because I think with these hard technical problems, to be fair and honest, a large portion of most of my career in tech has not been around solving hard technical problems. It's been about software eats the world, taking like pretty well understood software technical concepts and applying them to different domains and being able to do interesting stuff with it, right? There's, of course, hard problems building an Instacart or hard problems building Slack or even Atlassian, but they're not technological moats exactly, if that makes sense. Like there's not a moat that like, because we've solved this technical problem, no one else can come close. What I think is interesting about the Waymo example, and this may be true for many AI type companies, is there's not just technological advantage, but what I think they call like a process moat, which is we've learned how to do this really well and how to iterate and how to have our internal processes around this. So I imagine one of the process powers that Waymo has is we've collected not just all this data, but have all these ways that we've learned internally to react to a problem, an issue, and then integrate that into our training set to make us better and do new simulations, et cetera, that you can't just copy the code and do. You have to have done it before to be able to do it well. Pixar is a great example of process power. The fact that you've made so many movies and made a bunch of trial and error has taught you a bunch of things that are hard to copy. That you actually have to, I think of it as, what are the things you have to have gone through the pain of doing them in order to be able to do it well? And I wonder whether training AI models is for specific tasks is one of these things. And really between the 90% and the 100%, it's like easy to get to demo and kind of good. But the gap from there to amazing is actually non-replicable. Or if it took you 3 years to get there, it's going to take the next guy 2.5. So you always have a lead. And I think that's really interesting because personally, a lot of the products I've worked on where you're like, I'm building this technological or process advantage that no one else has. And that means we're 3 years ahead. It's mostly like money advantage or distribution advantage. And I think it's kind of cool that we're back to the nuts and bolts of no one knew how to like wire silicon this way, and they aren't going to be able to figure it out unless they do it. You can't just look at our chip and figure out how to build it. It's this, like maybe the same for AI models. You can't just look at our weights and figure it out, you know?
Well, you have this phenomena too, where you have a lot of PhDs who are leading the next gen of companies. And that wasn't true. Like that, not on the software side, you know, it was true on the hardware side.
Yeah.
But if you look at the last couple rounds of founders, they weren't coming from PhD backgrounds. And then I look at today with, especially at the foundation layer, so many that are coming out of academia. And I think that's really interesting. But I agree. I think there's a hard science to it. Hamilton Helmer wrote this great book on strategy, Seven Powers. One of those strategic differentiators, he did call the processing power. The Toyota way. And exactly to what you said, Fareed, it's like, if you get really good at the way in which you're building something, you really start to stay ahead of the pack.
Yeah.
Amazing. Because that kind of is, must be the secret. Because I often find myself wondering, and maybe you guys have theories as well, like about OpenAI's continued kind of, you know, even in the leaderboards today, a year after GPT-4 debuted, it's still the leader, which is kind of unbelievable, right? So is it a process thing? Is it a data set thing? Is it a technology thing? Probably all of those things. But no matter how you add it up, it's kind of amazing because there's many different ways to go about trying to reverse engineer what they've done, but others have tried and not succeeded yet.
I think there's a little bit of magic to this stuff. Tuning weights, messing around with inputs a little bit. And the analogy I use, just again, to use a Pixar analogy, is you have a physics simulator and you want it to like do something and it looks kind of messed up. And there's an art to tweaking a number, changing a thing, fiddling with a knob a little bit. And it takes an hour to run. So you have to have an intuition about how the inputs affect these complex chaotic outputs that you develop over time as you do it more. And so we had some people who are just like so good at knowing how the hair sims were going to react to certain things, and they could get to the answer faster instead of just doing brute force search, for instance, right? Across the complex input set. And I don't know a lot about AI modeling, but I suspect there is some like in the tuning, in the building a product, there's a little bit of this like intuition you develop over time about how to make, you know, a weird set of inputs turn into the GPT that doesn't swear at you, you know, or whatever. That's like a little bit of magic pixie dust. And I think they're maybe just better at it than others. I don't know.
I also feel like there are teams that they just have raw ambition. And having watched Uber in the early days or Facebook in the early days, it's almost like they had another gear. And some of the things that they were imagineering to do were multi-years down the road. Like Sam Altman coming in saying, hey, I'm going to raise trillions of dollars because we need chips available, reminds me of, you know, Travis while at Uber saying, hey, we need flying cars because these four-wheel things are just the point in time, and ultimately we're going to be flying our vehicles. And you know, there's good and bad to that. There's the thing about focus, but there's also this thing about, are you, you know, how big's the dream?
Yeah, I mean, other stuff I know about OpenAI, really flat org structure, very small versus what you imagine they would be. Small teams, mostly IC type things, at least in the product org. My understanding is they basically don't have a ton of PMs, then they're all sort of ICs. They hire very senior people to do those kinds of things, and they look for people who are builders. And I think it is, we've talked about this a bunch on the podcast, in a lot of ways, an archetype for what I think organizations of the future are going to look like, not only because of the leverage that these kinds of tools create, but also because of the realities of what the market is looking for. I think the future is very senior individual contributor product managers who can take on really big, hairy problems with small teams in really effective ways. And so they seem to be modeling that as far as my rough understanding of their orgs.
It must also be weird being a product person at OpenAI, because normally the bets you make, the costs you're creating, people costs. So they're relatively fixed. Effectively, they're fixed by time. But in this case, the bet that you're making could be $20 billion of training time. Literally $10 million of electricity. Yeah. And the bet turns out to be wrong. You're like, oh, well, there goes $20 million. Like, yeah. I mean,
we could have been mining Bitcoin with that.
Yeah. So like mostly in the software industry, we haven't had to deal with the physical economics of the things that we do. Yeah. Broadly speaking, have rounded to zero. So now we're in this new time where that is not true anymore. Like that, now these things do not round to zero. Even an AI feature in a product does not round to zero anymore. And so that's really interesting to think about the marginal cost of software, the marginal cost of training. Like it's a brave new world from that perspective in software.
Yeah. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll be dropping the episode on Devin from Cognition Labs and the Reddit IPO in just a few days.